Christina? Mother's voice filters down the stairs. Getting eggs at the hen house, Mother. Opening the door, I smile at Walton. He smiles back. I step onto the stoop, putting on the jacket. 2 dozen, yes? You can come with me if you want.
Butterscotch?
He holds out a piece of amber candy. Sure. He unwraps it before handing it to me.
Sweet for the sweet.
Thanks, I say, blushing. He gestures for me to lead the way.
Lovely property, he says as we stroll toward the hen house. Used to be a lodging house, Ramona said.
The butterscotch is melting in my mouth. I turn it over with my tongue. My grandparents took in summer guests. They called it Umbrella Roof Inn. He squints at the roof.
Umbrella?
You're right, I say, laughing a little. It looks nothing like an umbrella.
I suppose it keeps the rain out.
Aren't all roofs supposed to do that? Now he's laughing, too.
Well, you find out the answer and let me know.
Walton is right. My brother's scratchy jacket is too hot. After I've gathered the eggs, I peel off the jacket and Walton suggests we sit in the grass.
So what's your favorite color?
He asks. Really?
Why not?
The butterscotch clicks between his teeth. Okay. I've never been asked this question. I have to think about it. The color of a piglet's ear. A summer sky at dusk. Owl's beloved roses. Pink.
Favorite animal?
My spaniel, Topsy.
Favorite food?
I'm famous for my fried apple cake.
Will you make it for me?
I nod.
I'm going to hold you to that. Favorite poet?
This is an easy one. Emily Dickinson.
Ah, he says. Not knowing when the dawn will come, I open every door.
Or has it feathers like a bird?
Very good, he says, clearly surprised that I know it. Or billows like a shore.
My teacher gave me a collection of her poems when I left school. That's one of my favorites. He shakes his head.
I never understood that last part.
Well, I'm a little hesitant to offer an interpretation. What if he disagrees? I think it means that you should stay open to possibility, however it comes your way. He nods.
Ah, that makes sense. So are you?
Am I what?
Open to possibility?
I don't know. I hope so. What about you?
Trying. It's a struggle.
He tells me that he's going to Harvard to please his father, though he might have preferred the smaller campus of Bowdoin.
But you don't turn down Harvard, do you?
Why not?
Why not indeed, he says.
He likes you, Ramona says, eyes sparkling. He asks me all these questions. How long I've known you, if you have a boyfriend, if your father is very strict. He wants to know what you think. What I think? About him, silly. What you think about him? It feels like a trick question. As if I'm being asked to respond in a language I don't understand. I like him. I like many people, I say warily. Ramona wrinkles her nose.
You do not. You hardly like anyone.
I hardly know anyone.
True,
she says. But don't be coy. Does your heart pitter-patter when you think of him? Ramona, honestly. Don't act so scandalized. Just answer the question. Oh, I don't know. Maybe a little.
Maybe a little. That's a yes.
As the summer progresses, she goes back and forth between Walton and me like a carrier pigeon, carrying scraps of news, impressions, gossip. She is perfectly suited to the task. One of those girls with boundless energy and intelligence and no place to exercise them, like a terrier with a housebound owner. At first, Mother is formal and a little cool with Walton, but slowly he wins her over. I watch how he calibrates his behavior, deferring to her at every turn, calling her ma'am, presuming nothing. He coaxes her outside for picnics and afternoon sails.
Well, The boy does have excellent manners, she allows at the end of a long afternoon lunch on the shore. Must have learned them at an expensive school.
One morning, Mother surprises me by returning from town with a bolt of calico cloth, a packet of buttons, and a new butterick pattern. She hands it to me casually, saying, I thought you could use a new style. I look at the illustration on the cover. A dress with a 7-panel skirt and fitted bodice with small mother-of-pearl buttons. The calico is pretty. Flowers with green leaves on a brown sugar background. I set to work after my chores are done, cutting out each piece of the pattern, pinning the puzzle pieces of delicate tissue to the fabric, marking it with a nub of chalk, trimming along the solid line. I work in the orange light of an oil lamp and several candles as the sun drops from the sky. Late into the night I sit hunched over Mother's singer, feeding the fabric through, my foot pumping the treadle. Mother pauses in the doorway on her way to bed. She comes and stands behind me, then reaches down and traces the hem with her finger, smoothing it flat behind the needle. When I put on the dress the next morning, it skims closely over my hips. In the pantry, I hold the small cloudy mirror in my hand, turning it this way and that to get the full effect, but all I can see are bits and pieces. That turned out, is all Mother says when she comes into the kitchen to help with the noonday meal. But I can tell she's pleased. Later in the morning, Walton comes to the door with a bouquet of tulips and daffodils. He takes off his straw boater and bows slightly to Mother, who is sifting flour at the table.
Good day, Mrs. Olson.
She nods.
Good day, Walton.
He hands me the bouquet.
What a dress!
Mother bought me the fabric and the pattern. I hold out the skirt and turn so he can see all the panels.
Lovely taste, Mrs. Olson. It's beautiful. But wait, Christina, you made this?
Yes, last night. He grasps a piece of fabric from the full skirt and rubs it between his fingers, touches a mother-of-pearl button on my sleeve.
I am awed by you.
Behind me, Mother says, Christina can do just about anything she sets her mind to. This rare praise surprises me. She's usually so restrained. But then I remember that my mother was discovered in this house by a stranger at the door. She knows it's possible. One day when Walton is visiting, I tell him about the mystery tunnel, how I think of it as a mysterious and magic place, holding secrets that may never be revealed. Some think it's filled with buried treasure, I say. Show me, he says. I know my parents won't approve of our going alone, so we make a secret plan. We'll wait until Mother is resting. Papa is at the fishing weir with the boys, and no one will suspect I'm not where I usually am on a Wednesday morning, wringing clothes behind the house and hanging them on the line. He'll come quietly on foot, and if anyone is nearby, we won't attempt it. At breakfast, before heading off to the weir, my brothers help me fill the tubs with water. If anyone cared to notice, they might have seen that my dress is starched, my hair neatly braided with a ribbon, my cheeks pink, not from exertion, but from being pinched between my fingers, as Ramona taught me to do. Finding me in the yard behind the house after everyone has left, Walton silently takes the heavy, wet clothes from my hands. He begins to feed them through the wringer, turning the crank with one hand and coaxing them along with the other. At the clothesline, he lifts the damp pieces from the basket, shakes out the wrinkles, and hands them to me one by one as I pin them on the line. When the basket is empty, he lifts the rope and secures it to the poles. How thrilling it is, I am suddenly aware, to be playing house. Hidden among the damp and flapping clothes, Walton reaches for me, pulling me gently toward him, his eyes on mine. He lifts my hand to his mouth and kisses it, then tugs me closer, tilts his head, and kisses me on the mouth. His lips are cool and smooth. I feel his heart pulsing through his shirt. He smells of butterscotch, of spice, It's such a strange and heady experience that I can barely breathe. When I take the basket back inside the house, I slip out of my apron and smooth my hair, stealing a glimpse of myself in the fragment of mirror in the pantry. What I see looking back at me is a thin-faced girl with a too large nose and lively, if uneven, gray eyes. Her features may be plain, but her skin is clear, and her eyes are bright. I think of the man waiting for me outside. His hair, I've noticed, has begun to recede. His chest is lightly concave, like a teaspoon, his spine unnaturally stiff from that summer in a cast. When he's agitated, he has a slight lisp. It isn't inconceivable to imagine, is it, that this imperfect man could grow to love me? We walk silently, single file, in the shadow of the house and barn to the trees beyond the field. At this time of day, with the shadows as they are, we cannot be seen unless someone is actually looking for us. Walton reaches forward and brushes my fingertips, clasps my hand. Several times, making our way down a steep embankment, through a dense cluster of trees, we drop hands, but he finds my fingertips again, like a knitter seeking a dropped stitch. When we are out in the open, but hidden by the ridge, I pull on his hand playfully and he pulls back, bringing me to a stumbling stop. He is behind me, his breath on my neck, his arm at his side, holding me against him. "Heaven could not be better than this," he murmurs. I don't know whether he's talking about the pelt of water stretching out in front of us, the dancing grasses, the rocks with their mantle of inky seaweed, or me. It doesn't matter. This place, this point, is as much a part of me as my hair and nose and eyes. We are close to the lip of the tunnel. His hands on my waist, Walton turns me around, his forehead against mine.
"I've already discovered the treasure," he says. "All this time you were here, waiting to be found."
Walton's attention is like a sun high in the sky, so bright, so blinding, that everything else fades in contrast. The voices of my parents, my brothers, the clucking chickens and barking dog, rain on the roof like rice in a can. These noises simmer like a stew in the back of my brain. I am barely aware of them until my mother or a brother shakes my arm and says sharply, "Did you hear what I said? Do other people walk around in this state? Did my parents?" What a strange idea, that perfectly ordinary people with mundane lives might have once experienced this quickening, this vertiginous unfolding. Their eyes betray no evidence of it. Mame used to tell stories about natives on the islands she visited who'd never seen snow and had no language for it. That's how I feel. I have no language, no context for this. My friend Sadie says, "You're a goner. You'll move to Boston and we'll never see you again. Maybe I'll convince him to live here."
"And do what? He doesn't seem like the farming type."
"He wants to be a journalist," he says. "He can write anywhere."
"What's he going to write about? The price of milk?"
But what does Sadie know? Walton seems smitten with our way of life.
"This is so different from how I grew up," he says. "Your knowledge is real. It's practical. Mine is all in my head. I don't know how to foal a calf or skim cream from milk. I'm hopeless at sailing or harnessing a horse to a buggy."
"Is there nothing you can't do?"
"You're the one who can do and be anything you choose," I remind him.
"What I choose," he says, "is to be with you."
It feels as if my life is moving forward at two separate speeds. One at the usual pace, with its predictable rhythms and familiar inhabitants, and the other rushing ahead, a blur of color and sound and sensation. It's clear to me now that for 20 years I have gone through the motions of each day like a dumb animal, neither daring to hope for a different kind of life, nor even knowing enough to desire one. I am determined to keep up with Walton. I ask my brothers to bring the newspapers from town when they go for supplies. I want to learn enough to discuss politics and current events. The flood in Dayton, Ohio, and Irish Home Rule. The federal income tax and the suffragettes demonstrating in Washington. Woodrow Wilson's views on segregation and the assassination of King George of Greece. At the library in Cushing, I check out novels by authors Walton has mentioned, Willa Cather and D.H. Lawrence and Edith Wharton, all of which I read through a filter, thinking of him. She was afraid lest this boy, who, nevertheless, looked something like a Walter Scott hero, Lawrence writes in Sons and Lovers, who could paint and speak French, and knew what algebra meant, and who went by train to Nottingham every day, might consider her simply as the swine girl, unable to perceive the princess beneath. I'm afraid that I am the swine girl. But he treats me like a princess. Papa agrees to let me take Blackie and the buggy one afternoon, and I take Walton on a long tour from Broad Cove, with its views of the Outer Islands, to the quaint shops in East Friendship, to the pristine Ulmer Church in downtown Rockland. We end up in the grass on the hill overlooking Kissing Cove, eating egg salad sandwiches and home-canned pickles, drinking lemonade from a mason jar. As afternoon fades to evening, we watch the sun melt into the liquid horizon, a thin disk of moon emerging faintly above. "The stars are so close," he says, pointing up to the black expanse. "Like you could reach up and take one. Hold it in your hand." He pretends to grab one and hand it to me. "When I am in Cambridge and you're here in Cushing, I'll look up at the stars and think of you. Then you won't seem so far away." The final week of August is sodden, cloud-heavy, with an unwelcome chill that announces the end of summer as abruptly as a dinner host standing at the table to signal the end of the party. When Walton comes to say goodbye, I am so choked up I can barely speak. I had not realized how dependent I've become on seeing him. "I promise to write," he says. "And I promise too. But he doesn't yet have an address at Harvard, so I will have to wait for him to write first." Waiting to hear from him is agony. I plod to the post office once a day at noon. "I'm taking the buggy into town at 3 o'clock as always," Al says. "I can pick up the mail." "I like the fresh air," I tell him. The postmistress, thin, fussy, meticulous Bertha Dorset, eyes me with curiosity. I soon learn her routines. She keeps stamps in rolls in a tidy drawer and dusts the coin wrappers with a goose feather. Twice a day, according to a checklist on the wall behind her head, she sweeps the floor. At sunset every evening, she lowers the flag outside the post office, takes it off the pole, and folds it neatly into a box. When I arrive, she hands over the mail in our box, bills and circulars mostly. "That's it for today," she always says. I nod and try my best to smile. I feel like I'm living in a jail cell, waiting for release, the strain of listening for the man with the keys making me tense and jittery. After supper one night, as I'm clearing the dishes, my brothers are debating whether to take up the fish weir. It will be destroyed by ice storms if they wait too long, but on the other hand, the sardine catch is good, so it would be a shame to dismantle it too soon. And I think I might jump out of my skin. I snap at the boys, surprising myself at my own meanness. "For crying out loud, you clodhoppers, pick up your plates! Were you born in a barn?" There's thin satisfaction in their wounded surprise. And then one day, long after I've stopped believing there will be a letter, Bertha slides a pile of mail onto the counter. And here it is. A thick white envelope, with a red 2-cent George Washington stamp, addressed to me, Christina Olson.
"Well, look at that. Hope it's good news," she says.
I can barely wait until I'm out of the post office to open the envelope. I settle on a fallen tree just off the road and unfold the thick paper.
Dearest Christina,
I read hungrily, skipping forward, shuffling pages, 2, 3, 4, to the end.
Yours,
mine,
Walton.
My gaze catches on phrases.
Summer I will never forget. The way you shield your eyes from the sun with your hand, the flat collar of your sailor blouse, the blue-black ribbon in your hair. And finally, all roads lead back to Cushing for me.
I skip forward and back like a bee trying to escape from a hole in a screen. He can't stop thinking about the summer in Maine. The week he was in Malden was tedious and hot. Harvard is lonely after the sailing and picnics and endless adventures. He misses it all. The sloop moored in Kissing Cove. Egg sandwiches on just-baked bread. Ramona's silly jokes. Clam bakes down by Little Island. Pink-orange sunsets. But mostly, he writes, he misses me. The light is different on the walk home. Softer. Warm on my face. I tilt my chin up and close my eyes, putting one foot after the other, in the left-hand rut of the road. I can only walk like this, with my eyes closed, because I know the way by heart. Every week or 10 days, a thick letter in a white envelope with a 2-cent stamp arrives in the mail. He writes from the library, from the dining hall, from the narrow wooden desk in his dormitory room. By the light of a gas lamp after his rugby-playing, gin-guzzling roommate has gone to sleep. Each envelope, a package of words to feed my word-hungry soul, provides a portal into a world where students linger in wood-paneled classrooms to talk to professors, where entire days can be spent in a library, where what you write and how you write it are all you need to worry about. I imagine myself in his place, strolling across campus, peering up at thick-paned, glowing windows at dusk, going to expensive dinners with friends in Harvard Square, where the waiters wear tuxedos and look down their noses at the unkempt students, and the students don't care. As the letters pile up, I save them under my bed, tied with a pale pink ribbon. In one, he writes,
"Every night I look up at the great square in the southeast, nearly overhead, and name the stars in it. Broad Cove, Four Corners, East Friendship, and the Ulmer Church, and wish that I were driving around it with you."
After supper, I open the shed door and step outside, looking up at the vast expanse of stars. And imagine Walton doing the same in Cambridge. Here I am. There he is. Connected by sky.
The Cameo Shell. 1944 to 1946. For years, nobody has seemed particularly interested in the young artist who set up a studio in our house. But this summer is different. In town with my sister-in-law Mary, doing errands, I'm approached by a woman I don't recognize in the canned goods section of Fales.
"Excuse me, are you Christina Olson?"
I nod, puzzled. Why would a stranger know who I am?
"I thought so,"
she beams. "I'm renting a cottage near here with my family for the week. I've read about you and your brother, Al, is it?" Mary, who wandered over to the next aisle, comes around the corner.
"Hello. I'm with Miss Olson. Can I help you?" "Oh, I'm sorry. I should have cut to the chase. A famous painter is working at your home, I believe. Andrew Wyeth?
How do you..." Mary starts.
"I wonder if I might presume on you to get his autograph for me?"
The woman wheedles.
"Oh. Well..."
Mary asks, looking at me. I give the woman a tight smile. "No, that's impossible." Later, when I mention this to Betsy, she wags her head as if she's not surprised.
"Sorry about that, Christina.
Andy was on the cover of American Artist a while back, and we worried it might change things. Evidently it has.
Did he say anything about Al and me?
A little, not much. He may have mentioned your names. Of course, the article reveals that he summers in Cushing, so it probably isn't hard to figure out. I know he regrets saying anything. He really doesn't like being bothered. I'm sure you don't either.
I shrug. I'm not sure how I feel about it. Several weeks later, sitting in my chair beside the open kitchen window, I watch a baby blue convertible pull up in front of the house. The driver is wearing a cream fedora, the woman beside him a filmy polka-dotted headscarf.
"Toodaloo,"
she calls, waving pink-tipped fingers.
"Hello? We're looking for..."
She bats the man on the arm.
"What's his name, honey?"
"Wyeth."
"That's right. Andrew Wyeth."
She gives me a pink-lipped smile through the window. Andy isn't here yet, but I know I'll see him sauntering up the field from Kissing Cove any minute. "Never heard of him," I tell her.
"He's not painting inside this house?"
"Not last time I checked," I say. She purses her lips, perplexed.
"Frank, isn't this the place?"
"I don't know," he sighs. "You tell me."
"I'm pretty sure. That magazine said so."
"I don't know, Mabel."
"I could swear."
Sure enough, as they're chattering away, I see Andy coming toward us through the grass, swinging his tackle box of paints. Following my gaze, Mabel cranes her neck in his direction.
"Look, Frank,"
she hoots.
"That's probably him."
"That guy?" I say with a forced chuckle. "He's just a local fisherman." I raise my eyebrows at Andy, who sees me and pivots toward the barn. "We let him store his rods up here." Mabel sticks her lip out in a pout.
"Oh, darn it, we came all this way."
"He might sell you some mackerel. I could ask."
"Ew, no thank you,"
she sniffs, tightening her scarf around her hair. She doesn't bother saying goodbye. When they've turned their car around and headed off down the drive, Andy emerges from the barn. "Thanks. That was a close one," he says. "I need to keep my big mouth shut." "Might be a good idea," I tell him. We've had such a closed-off and intimate existence here that civilization has felt very far away. But slowly it's dawning on me that Andy belongs to the world, and not just to us. It's an unsettling realization. Many things are disquieting these days. In June of 1944, a torpedo zeroed in on John's ship off the coast of Normandy and killed 24 men. He almost didn't make it out alive. He clawed his way out of the sinking rubble with only the clothes on his back. "The watch I bought in Brooklyn for $100 was smashed to smithereens," he writes, months after the fact. "A day after we were hit, a sea-going tug towed us back to the English Channel, where we were put on a ship to Plymouth. I slept on a coil of rope and nearly froze to death, but I didn't care. I'm just happy to be alive." Does he come home after this? He does not. He is sent to England, Scotland, Ireland before a short leave in Boston and 45 days of training in Newport to become a crew member on an aircraft carrier. Then he heads to the South Pacific to fight the Japanese. Sadie, whose son Clyde also joined the Naval Reserve, tells me, "I'm always on high alert, listening for the sound of an unfamiliar car up the driveway. I know what she means. I wake in the night with a sense of dread that mostly dissipates by morning, but is never entirely absent. At random moments in the day and night I think, this could be the moment Sam and Mary arrive on my doorstep with a telegram. But perhaps not if I knead the dough until it's silky. Not if I pluck the chicken until it's smooth of feathers. Not if I sweep the floor and get rid of the cobwebs in the eaves." Early in the winter of 1946, Betsy writes with terrible news.
Andy's father and his nephew Newell were killed in October by a train in Pennsylvania. Mr. Wyeth was driving the car, which stalled on the tracks. Andy is bereft, she writes, but hasn't shed a tear. When they return to Maine for the summer, I can see right away how much his father's death has affected him. He is quieter, more serious. You know, I think my father might have actually been in love with her, he says when we're alone in the kitchen. Sitting in Al's rocker, he pushes it back and forth abstractedly with his foot. Heel, toe, creak, squeak. I'm confused. Sorry, Andy. Been in love with who? He stops rocking. Caroline, my brother Nat's wife. The mother of Newell, my nephew. The one who was... the one in the car. Oh. My. I'm having a hard time grasping what he's saying. Your father and... your brother's wife? I don't know any of these people by name. Andy has never really talked about them. Yeah. He rubs his face with his hand, as if trying to erase his features. Maybe. Who knows? At the very least, he was infatuated. My father was that way, you know. A man of great and varied passions, he says as if quoting an obituary. He never made any bones about that. But I think in the end he was miserable. Did something happen just before the accident? Did someone... Nothing happened, as far as I know. But I do know death was on his mind. I mean, it was one of his obsessions. You can see it in his work. It's in my work, too, but that's not... His voice trails off. It's as if he's talking to himself, hashing out what he feels, trying to settle on an interpretation. It was strange, he murmurs. After the accident, we found his painting gear carefully lined up in his studio, all in a row. He's normally like me, his stuff all over the place, you know. I think of the tempera splatters and crusted eggshells and petrified paintbrushes all over the house. I know. And maybe it was a coincidence, but the Bible in his studio was open to a passage on adultery. Or not a coincidence. I mean, it's not unreasonable to imagine that he was contemplating the consequences of an affair, whatever actually happened. But it doesn't mean he purposely... It seems out of character, I say. From what you've told me, you always described him as so present. Andy gives me a sardonic smile. Who knows what motivates anyone, right? Humans are mysterious creatures. He lifts his shoulders in a shrug. Maybe it was a heart attack. Or carelessness. Or something else. We'll probably never know the truth. You know you miss him. That's pretty simple, isn't it? Is it? I think of my own parents. How sometimes I miss them and sometimes I don't. I suppose not. Rocking slowly back and forth, he says. Before my father died, I just wanted to paint. It's different now. Deeper. I feel all the, I don't know, gravity of it. Something beyond me. I want to put it all down as sharply as possible. He looks over at me. And I nod. I understand this, I do. I know what it is to carry mixed feelings in the marrow of your bones. To feel shackled to the past, even though it's populated by ghosts. When his father died, Andy was working on a life-sized egg tempera of Al leaning against a closed door with an iron latch, next to our old oil lamp. He started it the summer before, trying, in sketch after charcoal sketch, to render on paper the scratched nickel of the lamp and the solid weight of the latch. Then he pulled out his paints and asked Al to pose next to the door in the kitchen hallway. For hours, days, weeks, Al sat against that door as Andy tried, and failed, to translate the vision in his head onto canvas. It's like trying to pin a butterfly, he said in exasperation. If I'm not careful, the wings will crumble to dust in my hand. When Andy left Port Clyde at the end of the summer, the painting still wasn't finished, so he took it back to his winter studio in Chad's Ford. After the accident, he started working on it again. When he returned to Maine, he brought the painting with him and propped it against the fireplace in the shell room. I'm standing near the fireplace looking at the painting one morning, when Andy arrives at the front door and lets himself in. Noticing me in the shell room from the hall, he comes to stand beside me. Al hated sitting still like that, didn't he? Andy says. I laugh. He was so bored and fidgety. He'll never pose for me again. Probably not, I agree. Half of the picture is in light and half in darkness. The oil lamp casts shadows across Al's face, on the old wooden door, under the iron latch. A newspaper behind the lamp is stained and wrinkled. Al is staring into the middle distance as if deep in thought. His eyes seem clouded with tears. Did it turn out how you wanted? I ask Andy. Reaching out a hand, he traces the outline of the lamp in the air. I got the texture of the nickel right. I'm happy about that. What about the figure of Al? I kept changing it, he says. I couldn't capture his expression. I'm still not sure I did. Is he crying? You think he's crying? I nod. I didn't intend that. But, with a rueful smile, he says, you can practically hear that wailing train whistle, can't you? It looks like Al is listening to it, I say. He moves closer, studying the canvas. Then maybe it did turn out all right. Andy has never asked me to pose for him. But several weeks after this conversation, he comes to me and says he'd like to do a portrait. How can I say no? He sits me down in the pantry doorway, arranges my hands in my lap and the sweep of my skirt, and draws sketch after sketch, pen on white paper, from a distance, up close. My hair, each minute strand, swept back off my neck. With a necklace, and without, my hands this way and that, the doorway empty, without me in it. Most of the time the only sounds are the scratch of his pen, the great flap of paper as he turns a large sheet. Squinting, he holds out his thumb. He sticks the pen in his mouth, leaving him inky-lipped, mumbles quietly to himself, "That's it. There. The shadow." I have the odd sensation that he's looking at me and through me at the same time. I hadn't quite noticed how frail your arms are, he muses after a while. And those scars. How did you get them? I've become so accustomed to dealing with people's reactions to my infirmity, uncertainty about what to say, distaste, even revulsion, that I tend to clam up when anyone mentions it. But Andy is looking at me frankly, without pity. I glance down at the criss-crossing strips on my forearms, some redder than others, the oven racks. Sometimes they slip a little. Usually I wear long sleeves. He winces. Those scars look painful. You get used to it. I shrug. Maybe you could use some help with the cooking. Betsy knows a girl. I do all right. Shaking his head, he says, you do, don't you, Christina? Good for you. One day he scoops up all the sketches and heads upstairs. For the next few weeks, I barely see him. Every morning he comes toward the house through the fields, his thin body swaying off kilter from that wonky hip, his elbows and knees flailing out, wearing blue dungarees and a paint-splattered sweatshirt, and old work boots he doesn't bother to lace. He raps twice on the screen door before letting himself in, carrying a canteen of water and a handful of eggs he's swiped from the hens. Exchanges pleasantries with Al and me in the kitchen. Thumps up the stairs in his work boots, muttering to himself. I don't ask to see what he's doing, but I'm curious. It's a warm, sunny day in July when Andy comes downstairs, and says he's tired and distracted, and maybe he'll take the afternoon off and go for a sail. After he leaves, I realize it's a good time to see what he's working on up there. No one is around. I can hoist myself up each stair as slowly as I want, resting every other step. Even before I open the door to the bedroom on the second floor, I smell the eggs. Pushing the door wide, I see broken shells and dirty rags and cups of colored water scattered all over the floor. I haven't been up here in ages. The wallpaper, I notice, is peeling off the wall in strips. Despite the breeze from an open window, the room is stuffy. I glance quickly at the painting, propped on a flimsy easel in the far corner, and look away. Pulling myself up onto the single bed, my childhood bed, I lie on my back, staring at the spiderweb fissures in the ceiling. Out of the corner of my eye, I can glimpse the rectangle of canvas, but I'm not ready to look at it directly. Andy told me once that hidden in his seemingly realistic paintings are secrets, mysteries, allegories, that he wants to get at the essence of things, no matter how ugly. I'm afraid to learn what he might see in me. Finally, I can't put it off any longer. Turning on my side, I look at the painting. I'm not hideous exactly, but it's a shock nevertheless to see myself through his eyes. On the canvas, I'm in profile, looking soberly out toward the cove, hands awkward in my lap, nose long and pointy, mouth downturned. My hair is a deep auburn, my frame thin and slightly off-kilter. The pantry doorway is rimmed in dark, half in shadow. The door is cracked and weathered. The grass is wild beyond. My dress is black, with a slash, a deep V, below my white neck. In the black dress, not what I was wearing, I look somber, severe, and utterly alone. Alone in the doorway facing the sea, my skin ghostly, spectral, darkness all around. Bridget Bishop, waiting to be sentenced. Waiting for death. I roll onto my back again. Shadows of the lace curtains, moving in and out with the wind, making the ceiling a roiling sea. When Andy comes in the next morning, I don't tell him I went upstairs. He says hello, we chat for a few minutes while I stir up drop biscuits, and he walks into the foyer, stops, comes back to the kitchen door with his hands on his hips. You went up. I spoon the dough onto a flat metal sheet, dollop after dollop. You did, he insists. How'd you know? He sweeps his hand up with a flourish. Path through the dust all the way to the top, like the trail of a giant snail. I laugh dryly. So what did you think? I shrug. I don't know about art. It's not art, it's just you. No, it's not. It's you, I say. Didn't you tell me that once? That every painting is a self-portrait? He whistles. Ah, you're too shrewd for me. Come on, I want to know what you think. I'm afraid to tell him. Afraid it will sound vain or self-important. It's so dark. The shadows. The black dress. I wanted to show the contrast with your skin, to highlight you sitting there. Now that we're having this conversation, I realize that I'm a little angry. I look like I'm in a coffin with the lid half shut. He laughs a little, as if he can't believe I might be upset. I stare at him evenly. Running his hand through his hair, he says, I was trying to show your... He hesitates. Dignity. Solemnity. Well, I guess that's the problem. I don't think of myself as solemn. I didn't think you did either. I don't. Not really. It's just a moment. And it's not really you. Or me. Despite what you think, his voice trails off. Seeing me struggle with the heavy oven door, he comes over and opens it for me, then slides the baking tray of biscuits in.
I think it's about the house.
The mood of it.
He shuts the oven door.
Do you know what I mean?
You make it seem so...
I cast about for the right word.
I don't know. Lonely.
He sighs.
Isn't it, sometimes?
For a moment, there's silence between us. I reach for a dish rag and wipe my floury hands.
So how do you think of yourself?
He asks.
What?
You said you don't think of yourself as solemn.
So how do you think of yourself?
It's a good question.
How do I think of myself?
The answer surprises us both.
I think of myself as a girl,
I say.
1914 to 1917. Everybody in town seems to know about the envelopes postmarked Massachusetts. I can tell Bertha Dorset has been gossiping, by the way she smirks and lifts her eyebrows when she hands me the mail. When I mention it in a letter to Walton, he writes,
I'm sorry that anyone should bother you with their curiosity,
and offers to use Ramona as a foil. She can address the envelopes from Boston, he says.
Then they wouldn't know that I was writing, but I'm afraid they would hear of it some other way.
I decide not to let it bother me. People will always talk. At least now they have good reason. In one of his letters, Walton says that he has tried, and failed, to grow sweet peas, his favorite flower, in his Cambridge apartment. In April, months before he is due to return, I send away for mail-order sweet pea seeds and ask Al to build a trellis. When the packet arrives, I soak the seeds overnight in water, drain them and chip one end with a sharp blade, then plant them in the manure-rich dirt. I feel like Jack anticipating his beanstalk. Sprigs sprout, grow into skinny stalks, and race up the lattice. By mid-June, when strawberries are ready to harvest, the sweet peas begin to flower. Though Walton has written to let me know the week he'll be back, and though Sam reports an in-town sighting, I am startled to see him coming up the path on a warm morning with a cluster of sweet peas in his hand and a wide grin on his face.
You're a sight for sore eyes,
he says when he arrives at the kitchen door, pulling me into a quick embrace. Handing me the bouquet, he says,
I know how much you like sweet peas.
And I want to say, no, you're the one who likes them. You know how much I like you. But I am oddly touched that he has conflated his feelings with mine. I have a surprise, I tell him, and make him close his eyes before leading him to the trellis. Open. He gives me a rueful look.
I'm sorry. Owls to Athens.
Great minds, I say. I grew these for you.
For me?
I nod. He moves closer, grasps my hand.
There's enough beauty here to lure me without sweet peas.
Welcome back, I think. I've never paid much attention to how I look, but all of a sudden I'm acutely aware of it. I notice the soiled patch on my blue chambray dress, the frayed sleeves of my muslin blouse, the dirty hem of my skirt. I run my fingers through my hair, separating it into oily strands. The entire family bathes on the third Monday of each month, in the same water in the kitchen, oldest to youngest, though in the summer the boys, never much for baths to begin with, get by with a swim in the lake or the ocean. Every few days I wash my face and under my arms with a wet cloth dunked in a pot of water warmed on the range. But that, I decide, isn't enough. I drag the old galvanized tin tub from the woodshed, with Al's help, and we fill pots with water from the pump in the pantry and carry them to the range to heat. When the water's close to boiling, we dump it in the tub and add buckets of cold water. Then I send him out of the room. In the tub I rub Castile soap across my arms, my legs, my pale stomach, the downy fur under my arms and between my legs. Dipping my head, I wet my hair
and run my soapy hands through it, my fingers strange on my scalp, like someone else's. After rinsing my hair, I pour apple cider vinegar into a cupped hand, as Mother taught me, and run it through the strands until they squeak. The water is soothing on my knotted muscles and floating arms, free of gravity's pull. My legs are floating, too. When I was younger, I would bathe in the pond with my brothers sometimes, reveling in the weightlessness, the momentary release from pain. Now the bath is the only place I can find this relief. I shut my eyes, savoring it, leaning back against the cold tub. I fantasize about what it would be like to leave this place. I envision the moment as if I'm a character in a story. A young woman rises while the rest of the house is asleep, gathers some items into a bundle, makes her way down the stairs as quietly as she can, as she is accustomed to do, waking before the others to stoke the fire and prepare breakfast. She laces her shoes in the shadows of the front hall and opens the door to the outside, light on her feet as a ballerina, weightless as a butterfly. She slips down the steps and around the corner, beyond the house and the barn to the automobile that waits out of sight, a young man behind the wheel. Walton, of course. Who else would it be? He takes her bag, tosses it over the seat. In her bag, a chambered nautilus, an empty picture frame decorated with shells that awaits a moment worth remembering. Almost everything else she leaves behind, bits and pieces of a life outgrown. Whatever she'll need in the future can be found where she's going. As the summer progresses, we fall into our routines from the year before. Boating with the Carls, clam bakes on the rocks by Kissing Cove, picnics in the meadow. One day as we're meandering down to Bird Point, he says, "It would be terrific if you could come to Boston this fall." I feel a surge of pleasure. I would like to.
You could stay with the Carls, I'm sure.
And? He hesitates, and I hold my breath, hoping he'll make the invitation more personal.
Perhaps you might see a doctor for your affliction while you're there.
I stop walking in surprise. We haven't ever explicitly talked about my condition, though I've come to rely on his arm under mine.
You want me to see a doctor? These country physicians are well-meaning, no doubt. But I doubt they're conversant in the latest advances. Wouldn't you like to find out what's wrong with you?
Wrong with me? I stammer. My skin feels cold. He taps his forehead with two fingers.
Forgive me, Christina. What ails you, I should have said.
You don't complain, but I can imagine how much you suffer.
As one who cares about you.
His voice trails off again, and he grasps my hand.
I'd like to see if something can be done.
These concerns are reasonable, even logical. So why do his gentle entreaties make me want to put my hands over my ears and beg him to stop? You are kind to want to improve my welfare, I tell him, striving for a neutral tone.
Not at all. I only want for you to be well. So will you consider it?
I would prefer not to,
said Bartleby.
He flashes a smile, breaking the tension. Bartleby. From the recesses of my school brain I dredge the reference. The obstinate Scribner. I smile back.
I only want what's best for you, you know.
You're what's best for me, I say. August is exquisite agony. I want each day to last forever. I am fretful, fevered, perpetually irritated by everyone but Walton, to whom I'm determined to show my best self. It's a peculiar kind of dissatisfaction, a bittersweet nostalgia for a moment not yet past. Even in the midst of a pleasurable outing, I'm aware of how ephemeral it is. The water is warm, but will cool. The ocean is a sheet of glass, but wind is picking up, far across the horizon. The bonfire is roaring, but will dwindle. Walton is beside me, his arm around my shoulder,
but all too soon he will be gone. On our final evening as a group, sitting on the beach, making conversation, Walton mentions the almanac's prediction of a hard winter ahead, and Ramona says, "Will Christina ever know anything except a hard winter?" She doesn't look at him when she says it, but we all know what she's asking. If and when Walton is going to offer a way out. He seems oblivious.
"Christina's not like us, Ramona. She likes the cold Maine winters, isn't that so?"
he asks me, squeezing my shoulders. I look at Ramona, who shakes her head slightly and rolls her eyes. But neither of us says anything more. Flowers fade, freeze in an early frost, wither on the vine. Trees burst into flame and burn themselves out. Leaves crumble to ash. All the things about life on the farm that once contented me now fill me with impatience. It has become harder to tolerate the months after summer ends. The plodding regularity of my daily chores, the inevitable descent into darkness and cold. I feel as if I'm on a narrow path through familiar woods, a path that goes around and around with no end in sight. I spend the early fall canning and preserving and pickling tomatoes, cucumbers, strawberries, blueberries, shelving the jars in the shed. Alvaro slaughters a pig, and we carve and cure and smoke every last bit of it, from hoof to curly tail. We trowel up and store unlovely root vegetables, rutabagas and turnips and parsnips and beets, pluck apples and lay them out on a long table in the cellar for the long winter ahead. I have too much time to think. I torment myself. All I do is work and think. I feel like the mollusk in Mamet's Nautilus, grown too big for its shell. A woman my age, I think, should be laboring for her own husband and children. All around me, friends and classmates are becoming engaged and getting married. The boys I went to school with are settling into lives as farmers and fishermen and shopkeepers. The girls, Sadie and Gertrude among them, are setting up house and having babies. When I trudge through my tasks, Mother chides me. "Pick up your feet, my girl. Life is not as tragic as all that." And Al looks at me sideways. And I know what they're thinking. That it might have been better if Walton had never come along. But Walton's letters are hot air balloons, lifting me out of melancholy. He writes about his classes, his teachers, his thoughts about his future career. Though he's been training as a journalist, news about the war raging in Europe dominates the papers, making it a hard time to break into domestic reporting, he says. He has decided to shift his sights to teaching. Teachers are always needed, whether a war is raging or the stock market is falling. It's not lost on me that he could be a teacher anywhere, even in Cushing, Maine. Winter passes as slowly as a glacier melts. Christmas and New Year's provide momentary distraction before we settle into months of ice and snow. Walking back from the post office in the late afternoon gloom of a February day, I am tucking Walton's letter inside my coat when my shoe catches on a protruding chip of ice and I crash to the ground. I prop myself on an elbow, noting with strange detachment my torn stockings, the thin coating of blood on my shin, a throbbing pain in my right hand, the one I used to break my fall. Tentatively, I extend my left arm and begin to hoist myself up. I pat my jacket. The letter must have flown from my pocket when I fell. I feel around on the ground, muddying my skirt even further, my blood pinking the ice. Several yards away, I spy the envelope and limp over to it. Empty. The sky is darkening, the air is cold, my shin is throbbing, and still I continue as desperate as an opium addict. I can't leave until I find it. And then I see the folded pages, fluttering in the ditch. When I reach them, I find that the ink has run. The letter, mud-spattered, water-soaked,
appears to have been written in a diabolical code designed to drive the recipient insane. I can only identify every fourth or fifth word or phrase.
Entertaining, I am glad to say. Beginning to enjoy.
And after straining to make out the letters with increasing exasperation,